You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedians Comedian Podcast.
Hello there, welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith. Today I'm talking to an amazing comedian. This is Mr. Mike Gunn.
Well, I think I'm probably coming at comedy from a different perspective than most people anyway.
In what respect?
I got into it not through art, you know, through drama classes or da-da-da-da, but I got into it because of a horrendously screwed up drug background.
Yeah.
And, you know, and once you've kind of been through all that, once you've been through like 10 years of drug addiction and therapy and, you know, psychiatric hospital and all that, you can't really work in a bank anyway.
Well, that's as good a starting point as any. Tell me about that. Give us a bit of background on that. I knew, and I know from your, you know, as a chortle review online of your show Uncut, I never saw. How long ago did you do Uncut?
Oh, God knows. And there's the poster.
Oh, it should be said, I was going to mention before, this, your office looks the most like an office I've seen anyone working. You've got posters of your, you know, and you at the store. And things in frames in front of you've even got a little tray of like an in tray.
I have
as well.
You see all that paper in there, that top one. That's all comedy I've written.
No, it isn't. Really?
Yeah, that's not worked.
So there's a constant in tray staring at you. Amazing.
That's all stuff that's not funny in there.
So you say you were turning around to look. When was that? When was Uncut?
Oh, God,
do you
knows.
Remember?
I don't know. 2004.
Okay. And that was a show about
Six.
Your...
I'm drug-addled, remember? I've
yes.
got no idea.
Sure. Well,
it was a show about... it was basically a sort of linear progression of... it was the easiest show I've ever written. It was just, you know, I was born, got into a huge heroin addiction problem, used every drug known to man... And then after that, heroin for 10 years intravenously, and then stopped that. You know, went to rehab and came out and thought, oh, what am I going to do with my life?
Okay.
I mean, not very much. I'll do stand up comedy.
Okay.
That's kind of, you know.
That's the potted history of it.
That's the potted history of it, yeah. I know, I'll write a show about this.
Yeah. I mean, that sounds
quite
like.
That simple.
I'm desperate to talk to you about that because that sounds like a sort of a whole other podcast in itself. But let's talk about that a bit and see what we can glean from the relationship between those experiences and the comic you are now and the way you're coming at
okay,
it.
Okay, yeah.
So just for the sake of background, I knew of this, but we never talked about it before. How did you get into drugs? Was it like a recreational fun thing? Were you troubled?
Cool. I was troubled. And I think all comics are troubled, aren't they, on some level?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I'd rather be in a room full of strangers than with my loved ones.
Exactly. You know, I want a room full of drunk people to love me.
Yeah.
You've got to have some problems, if that's your aim in life. You know, reminds me of my childhood. I don't know. Why did I get into drugs? Because everyone I knew was into drugs. I was kind of disenfranchised and felt outside. And, you know, it was 1977. Punk rock was happening. You know, I liked Lou Reed and Keith Richards and you know, everyone I liked seemed to be into heroin.
Okay. And were you coming at this from a sort of a working class background or a fairly middle class?
You know, there were lots of kind of family problems, divorced parents, and all sorts of stuff I probably wouldn't want to go into on this. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I, you know, got into taking, you know, dope, speed, acid, mm-hmm. you name it. Sadly, no ecstasy. Yeah, it's really sad. I gave up. I stopped using drugs in 1986. And just as ecstasy hit the street. All my friends were loved up. I was furious.
Oh, there must be a whole raft of people. There must be, in fact, it must be quite an exclusive club, actually, of people who gave up just before the really good stuff
really
started.
Annoying.
Oh, God.
I'm not sure if it really classes as really good stuff. Anyway,
I should agree with that as well. It's easy to look at that from a comedy perspective. Obviously, there are people.
Well,
that, serious
I think that's why I fit in nicely into the comedy. There are very few jobs, I don't think, where you can talk about having acid flashbacks and being in therapy and doing, you know, rehab and you know, fixing up heroin and, you know. And people not go, what?
Yes, sure.
And people just go, oh, yeah, I've done that. There aren't many jobs where you could fit in with all that sort of a background.
Yes. I mean, presumably the few other jobs where you could fit in with that would be full of other people going, oh, would you like some? Yeah, Whereas you're sort of inviolable, aren't you? You're on stage. There is a wall protecting you from those experiences in a kind of way because you can say on stage, this is...
Although I don't, actually. I don't really mention on stage. I tried for a while to talk about not taking drugs in a comedy club.
Okay.
And, you know, it's like saying you don't like football. Jesus, you have to deal, you know, Chelsea or that.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
You know,
you were saying that you and which way round was that? You were saying that, hey, I used to take drugs, or let's talk about... What was the thrust of that when you were trying to approach the subject of drugs?
I tried to talk about not having... being teetotal, basically.
Gotcha.
In a comedy situation, and it's no good. You know, I've got jokes about not drinking, but I've learned over the years that it's best to say, oh, I'm having a couple of days off drinking, rather than...
That's fascinating! Oh, my God, because it would be like saying, so, I'm a Christian.
Exactly,
or something like that.
Exactly.
It would be,
Talk about therapy on stage. I mean,
yes.
Know, no one's... how many Americans have you seen making that mistake, especially women, coming over and going, hey, my therapist, the audience turn off immediately. Shut up, we don't want to hear you.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've done therapy. I'm doing therapy at the moment, and I'm finding it fascinating, and I think it's interesting. And I'd love to talk about it because it is such a taboo thing that so many people are in. I've got to try it. Maybe I'll try it on a sort of one-off free friend show that I can happily then jettison if it doesn't work. But I know exactly what you mean. There are certain things that I don't know exactly what you mean. It's a bit more pronounced in your case, but it does seem that's fascinating to hear that if you mention that, then there's already a tension.
Oh God, yeah. I understand it because there people are out in the club drinking and probably taking drugs and all that, and they don't really, they're out for a good night out. They don't really want to hear about, you know, someone that's kind of screwed up their life massively by doing that. Especially as most people, you know, don't screw up their lives. I'm not anti-drink or drugs in any way. You know, most people take drugs and drink and have a jolly good time with it.
Yeah.
You
know? And manage not to really screw it home and ruin themselves. Yeah.
Exactly. Unless you're kind of like me, you know, with no kind of balance whatsoever and just did it until, you know, I took heroin until I was 9 stone. You know, bright yellow and in psychiatric hospital, and even then I was going, oh, fine.
God. Oh my God.
You know, I'm alright. Just need a couple of days rest, I'll be fine.
So you just bringing it back to the idea, I'd like to talk about this a little bit more, talking about things on stage which people don't seem to accept. Let's keep doing that for the moment.
Okay.
and then come back
you
in a bit.
You can't say you're teetotal, it's pretty weird. I don't think you could talk about being a Christian.
Yeah,
you can't
it's so
say,
weird, isn't it?
You can't say women are fat. especially if they are.
Okay.
Although I did last night and it got a big laugh, but it's tricky.
Yes, you had to tread carefully. And how odd that, because for like with the therapy thing for me, there and I'm sure the same with the drugs, I'm sure the same with any of these things, there will be people out there who had experience of therapy who maybe they want to hear it talked about, or maybe if you can say it in the right way, if you can say a funny thing about it, like there must be, for example, say using drugs, say in a particular club I'm thinking of in the Northwest, you can be fairly sure 25% of the men in the audience are on coke and zipping away and doing lines in the toilet. But it has to be kept secret for them, to the extent that you could never go, so who's on coke?
No.
Do you think in case people go, I've lost my job, you know?
Exactly.
So there is, it remains a taboo that people don't feel they can laugh at.
Yeah.
So that is, I suppose that is a sort of, I guess as what I'm getting at is, as comedians, we feel like any subject is right for comedy, but only as long as an audience is prepared to.
Well, yeah, it really shows up when you do a corporate show, you know, in an office, and the things that would go down fantastically well in the club and fantastically well with each of those individual people, probably once they're all together in a corporate situation, there's no way they're going to laugh at it. Because they're sat next to their boss or their wife or whatever, it's awkward. I even found when I was I sort of did a whole hour on the heroin addiction, a cheery subject. I even found that the people who came to see that, there was a level they weren't going past.
Okay.
Yeah, because basically it was the easiest show I ever wrote. I just wrote down, what I did during my drug addiction and told people, and a lot of it is funny what drug addicts do, but there was, for instance, there I did this bit which I thought was incredibly funny, that towards the end of my drug I was so paranoid about being arrested and all that, so the only place I would inject would be in whilst driving a car, because I thought if you were driving fast in a car, no one can surprise you, no one can jump out and you grab you, you can't be arrested, you're there and you're in a sort of metal bubble, safe.
Yes,
that's what I thought was
that's
really
bananas.
Safe, but you tell that to an audience of people and they're not thinking, oh, this is a funny routine, they're thinking, fuck me, there's people out there injecting themselves in cars.
Yes, sure. Sure. Oh my god.
Whereas I could get away with that routine, which I in a rehab, which I've done lots of kind of drug rehabs, which is my that's my target audience for that show.
Okay, yeah, sure.
They find it hilarious, of course. They absolutely love it. You know, that's the best routine in that show. But say it to normal people, it dies completely.
Yes, you're not telling me there's a rehab circuit. Is there? Was the show written
there
with?
There is a kind of. I've done quite a few rehabs. Yeah.
Okay.
I do, because they have conventions and all that sort of stuff. And yeah, I've done some. I went back and did the rehab that I was in, actually, which was it was fantastic.
Oh my god, that must have been, what a personal achievement. That's like the end of a movie, isn't it?
And here he is performing his show. It was great. It was really good. Really enjoyed it.
So in the writing of that show, you were going through all of these different experiences and finding the funny in them from the perspective of someone who was already a working club comic. That was something that wasn't the first show you wrote.
No, that was a thing you decided to come to.
So I'm just wondering about the context of doing those shows, because obviously in the right context of a rehab centre, people get it and it works. I wonder if someone the obvious example would be someone like Russell Brand, who's kind of overcome drug addictions to become very famous.
Yeah.
Whether he could, do you think he could tell those stories to his audience, or do you think there would still be a line whereby, what I mean is, like, if you were globally famous as being a guy who'd recovered from it, could you see that material working then? Do you think your audience would be wanting to hear those stories, or do you think there would still be a line?
There's still a line.
Yeah.
I think there's still a line. Some stuff that junkies find funny, I don't think the average person finds funny. The thing is, if you're a drug addict and you're sat around with a load of people and somebody ODs and dies, the natural response of the drug addict is, Jesus, where did they get their gear? It must be good. Okay.
Oh my god.
Exactly. Now you can say that in a room full of drug addicts and they'll all identify and think that's a funny thing.
Yes.
But if you say it to a normal person like I just did to you, you go, oh my god.
Yes. Yeah.
So I think no matter how famous you are, there's still gonna be a line.
Yeah, you're right, actually. Having said that, I can't think of much of Russell Brand's, to use that example, I don't know, has material about being covered in puke. And, you know, I think it's sort of, it's an exception. It's like a rock star face of it, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. Which, of course, it's not like that at all.
Sure, sure.
No. I'm sure even rock stars don't really, you know, it's not glamorous, is it?
No. No, sure. Or, I mean
drug taking can be glamorous, but drug addiction can't be.
Yes.
Big difference, I think.
Yeah. No. Oh, that's one of the wisest things anyone's said on the podcast. That's great. That's lovely.
It's not really about comedy, though.
Yeah, no, that's all right. All the best stuff, isn't it? That's fine. So here's Mike, and this is one of my all-time favourites. There's real insider stuff here as well. Obviously, Mike is a brilliant comedian. He's a big fan of the podcast, which is always lovely. And he's a very warm and a very funny man. But over and above all of those things, which would ordinarily make for a fascinating chat, this is one of those shows where we're going to get right inside Mike's process. There's lots of really, really specific stuff in here, really specific examples of things that you can use right away, writing techniques and so forth, if you're a comic or if you want to be a comic. And there's some brilliant tips. There's some very specific tips for new acts who want to work at the Comedy Store. And there's also Mike's whole system for writing jokes that includes not just technical stuff of how to actually find the funny in subjects, but also how to fit those exercises into your life. On top of that, there's also how to survive at corporate. Not even how to survive at corporates. There's how to excel at corporates and any kind of... I'll let Mike explain what we mean by those when we get to them. But there's just so much. This is absolutely bursting with stuff. I think I say a couple of times during this show, I really don't want to give this episode away. I want to keep it for myself. It's got so much hands-on stuff I think you're really going to enjoy. A couple of little admin things before we do. Thank you very much, all you people who are funny for no money. I'm really enjoying your contribution. I'm just quickly going to read some of the best funny for no money challenge results. I was after titles for an Edinburgh show about war and fish, or the world of the sea. And it's really good to know that there are so many people out there who are funny for no money, who are non-comedians who enjoy the show. And it's really, really encouraging to know that so many of you are absolute idiots. Featuring Mr. AJ Bell with God Krill Hunting. Cod Krill Hunting. It's a double one. It's still not really a war film, but it doesn't matter. It's fun. Matt Butterworth with Inglorious Bass Sharks. Ah, it's painful. Bloody Helm. This was his third try, and he got as far as Adolfin Hitler. Shocking. The Great Westie. Crouching Tiger, Squid and Dragon. They start to get quite good now. Being and Tim gave me Bed Knobs and Crab Sticks, which, again, sort of doesn't work, but it's fun. Fun to say. M. Woods and also Matt Green both submitted Prawn on the 4th of July. And now we're on to the winners. These are my three winners. I thought Prawn was very good, but these three were sensational. Rivet Master with Stew Tells Wee Shells of the Sea War, which I believe he also then wrote, he or she, apologies, then wrote Sorry afterwards, and you apologise in good time. Bert War with Crackin' Off, which is a tremendous phrase that I hope someone will put on a t-shirt and send to me with a picture of Kraken. And the winner is LaRusso Lost with The Sea Bomb. Oh, it's so clever. Think about it. The Sea Bomb. Brilliant. Maybe cleverer than it is funny, but it certainly tickled me. So well done to you three. You will win a slow motion high five. Also, Super Goldsmiths this week are Lindsay... I don't know how to pronounce this because it's on Twitter. It might be Lindsay EC or Lindsay Eck or even Linz IC. I've no idea. LaRusso Lost and Wormito all telling me that they've told people about the show who then really enjoyed it. So thanks to them. You're all Super Goldsmiths. And the new Funny for Money, we'll do this very, very quickly. Funny for No Money. If you are funny for no money, or if you've ever been paid for doing comedy ever, then your hashtag is Hack for Cash. Get in touch with me at ComComPod. I'm going to do a show about birds and crime. What am I going to call it? Get Cracking. That Get Cracking is the answer. That's my telling you to get stuck in. Last two little bits of admin. James Acaster, the live special, is going to be on Wednesday, the 6th of February. James is going to be doing a set, and then we'll talk about his life, his comedy, and the stuff that he has just performed. Only the interview is going to be podcast, so if you want to get the most out of that show, come and see the live show. Come and see the fabulous James Acaster doing half an hour of new stuff, his old favourite stuff, whatever he does, we're going to talk about it and go into it with a bit more depth. So do come and see that live. Details are on the Facebook page. You can also access that through comedianscomedian.com. Tickets are selling fast, I assume. I have no way of checking until I work out how to do that, but they're probably nearly all gone. So do get stuck in Wednesday the 6th of February at a secret location in London's glittering West End. And finally, this chat I had with Mike, we spoke for 2 hours or more, so I had a real difficulty deciding which bits of that to put on the podcast. I have finally succumbed and made another extras download. So it's an MP3 with about 40 minutes on it of extra stuff. That's all Mike's stuff about touring with Sean Collins post-roadshow. Some great stuff about doing McIntyre's roadshow as well. Some very specific tips for acts doing the tryout spot at the Comedy Store. There's some stuff about Mike's experience of the Edinburgh Fringe. We're going to be dealing with the issue of plagiarism, and I'm not. I really want to make clear we're not being salacious about that, but Mike is dealing with that issue in this conversation very, very sensitively. But it's a very interesting perspective on what happens when your stuff goes walkabout. And there's even more concrete ideas and tips for dealing with corporates. So go to comedianscomedian.com/Mike, M-I-K-E, for those extras. Follow the steps, put in your email address. If you've ever downloaded extras before, then just put in your email address and it'll download automatically. If you haven't, then you'll need to sign up. Just follow the steps. Still taking suggestions for Australian and New Zealander comics that you'd like on the show. I'm going out there for 3 months early next year. So email info@comedianscomedian.com or tweet me @comcompod. That's everything. Let's get stuck back in. This is just one of my favourites. I will take you back now to Mr. Mike Gunn.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Welcome to Sincerely Sloan, presented by Uninterrupted. I'm your host, professional tennis player, wife, parent, and entrepreneur, Sloan Stevens. As an athlete and as a person, my journey has had a lot of twists and turns, from moments of adversity and doubt to unimaginable triumph and satisfaction. Throughout the season, I'm joined by some of the biggest names in sports, entertainment, culture, and a few members of my tribe. Our conversations keep it real and push it past skin deep. We reveal the perspectives, routines, and products that allow each of us to show up at our best. Join me on my journey of self-discovery and many, many laughs along the way. Sincerely, Sloan.
Let's talk about you coming out of that then. And so what was the period in between giving up the drugs and becoming a stand-up comic? Let's just place you in your origin story.
I gave up, which just sounds like a very simple thing to do, but of course it wasn't a simple thing to do. I did psychiatric hospital rehab, lots and lots of therapy. It took years and years and years to get to the point where, and I got a job. I came out of all that and I got a job, and this all took, I don't know, 7-8 years, whatever, you know, a long time anyway. And I got a job repairing photocopiers, okay? And I was doing that job, and there's a funny little story, actually. When I was first out of rehab, you're emotionally unstable when you come out of rehab. You've been taking drugs all your life. You suddenly stop, and suddenly you're back to where you were when you started. So you're emotionally like a 12-year-old.
Sure.
And, you know... And you remember Kerry Katona in the jungle bursting into tears all the time. And,
yes.
And actually, like, well, you like that. So I came out of rehab. I got this job as a photocopy repairman. And I was working in a school. Okay, I went to this school to repair their photocopier. And it was a kids' school. They're all kids' schools. Anyway, I was in the room. It was a little hallway, a hall. And all the children came in. The photocopy was in the corner. The children came in. They're all infants in their school uniform. They sat in a big ring on the floor. Held hands, the teacher was there, and they started singing a song, okay, and it was a happy song. I'm in the corner, fresh out of rehab, okay, trying to repair the photocopier. not knowing anything about, I'd lied and said I knew how to repair bridges. I didn't. It's hard to get a job when your CV is, sure, I've been a drug addict for all my life. Yeah.
Yes.
So anyway, so I'm in the corner, they're singing. I'm emotionally unstable, fresh out of rehab, and they're singing a happy song, and I thought, oh my God, I'm going to cry.
Yeah.
So I thought, I can't cry in front of all these kids. So I thought, I've got a choice. I can either run out crying, it's going to be a bit weird, yeah, I'm going to lose my job first day, or I thought, I'll get down behind the photocopier and they won't be to see me and I'll be to cry. Okay. So I'm crouched behind the photocopier crying. Okay. The kids are singing. I'm occasionally tapping it with a screwdriver, make it seem like I'm doing something. And one of the kids sees me, puts his hand up, and the teacher says yes. He says, "Miss, the photocopy repairman is crying."
Oh my God!
So they're all the attention. I have to say something. So I say, "It's a very serious fault." I haven't got the right tools. So that's where I was at, okay? I was fresh out of rehab, emotionally unstable.
This is like, I was just thinking, this is like the selfish giant. I was hoping to see you as you look now, surrounded by these kids holding hands.
So basically, I didn't fit in very well in the photocopy repairing, and also, like you, I did a lot of therapy and all that stuff, and I suddenly came to the conclusion, I suddenly thought, hang on a minute, I haven't been through all this addiction, all this rehab and all that, to bloody repair photocopiers.
Yeah,
this
right.
is not where I'm at.
Okay.
I've felt like an alien anyway. And I just thought I've got to look around for something else to do, that, you know, something that I actually want to do.
It's almost a very much, it's like a careers advisory chat. Like if you said to someone, I feel like an alien, I feel disenfranchised, I'm used to being on my own and kind of living by my wits.
Exactly.
What have you got for me? Well, exactly. There is this one thing. Yeah.
Exactly. And I did a couple of little courses. I did circus skills.
Did you?
I did circus skills. One. I did juggling, all that sort of stuff. I can juggle clubs.
Lovely.
Just about. And I did that, and I did a few. I did electronics, and I was in Covent Garden watching one of those guys juggling. And I know this is your background.
Sure.
And he was juggling, I can't remember, 7 balls or something. Anyway, something, you know, and he threw them all up, and he caught one on each foot, one on each hand, one on the back of his neck.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was a fantastic trick. And, you know, it was splashing of applause. And then he told the joke and got a big laugh.
Yes.
Right? And
yes.
he said... You know, he said something like, 7 years it took me to learn that with the juggling, and I get a bigger response for this cheap joke. And I thought, he's got a point there.
Yeah. Just a note to any listeners, send me an email, info@comedianscomedian.com, if you know who that was. Because I've got a couple of ideas, but someone will know, like Noel Britton or someone will be in touch.
Okay. And then I went and did a stand-up comedy course at Jackson's Lane. Oh, not only because of that, but also because I was quite shy and insecure and, you know, emotionally unstable. And as part of my kind of recovery to get back into the world, I thought if I could just stand up in front of people for 5 minutes and do something, that would be a real major boost to my confidence.
Sure.
I never thought I'm going to be a stand-up comedian for a job.
Yes.
I was just reaching around to try and kind of get myself something to do in the world and be a bit confident. And I went and did a Jackson's Lane course in 95, I think, and with very good teachers. Andy Parsons is one of the teachers.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Nick Wilty, Charmaine Hughes, Dave Thompson. Anyway, a different teacher each week. And I was so unsuitable for stand-up comedy. I was so shy and awkward and insecure that whenever I spoke, it got a big laugh.
Oh, wow.
Because it was just too wrong.
Because it was
wrong.
Really raw and
so
honest.
Wrong.
And
so wrong.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. And I think I got the bug for it then, basically. I thought, yeah, actually. Also, the other thing, of course, is after you've had a big career of injecting lots of, you know, speed and coke and heroin and all, you know, you need some adrenaline rush.
Yes, okay. Is it comedy is your methadone? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, basically, yeah. I think I needed something where there was going to be highs and lows and, you know, lots of, you know.
What's fascinating to me about this, or one of the fascinating things about this incredible story, is that you come at comedy almost... The most healthy way round. You know what I mean? Yeah, like you've come to it and gone, this is... I mean, I'm not saying the origin was healthy, but the direction from which you approach comedy, you weren't desperate to make people laugh and needing a thing in your life, you were making decisions about this would be really good for me to do. You've actually used it as a patch, as a, like a software patch. A you know, patch, you've gone like a this will heal me.
Yeah.
Do you think it's been successful in?
I think it's been very
that?
Successful. Yeah.
You seem very happy. You've got lovely kids. We're in your
I've
lovely
got kids,
house.
I've got a nice house, a couple of cars.
There's got to be a lot of ex-junkies you haven't.
Oh
done
God!
This
nearly
well.
Everyone I know who I use with nearly all dead. They're nearly all dead. They were nearly all dead 15 years ago.
Sure.
They're either dead in prison or religious in that kind of mental religious way where you go around stopping people in the streets and going, Jesus loves you, and you
yes,
know,
okay.
following them home, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Or standing, you know, those people you see standing in Leicester Square going, sure. no, you'll die, and all that business. Yeah, yeah. One
well,
of
that's
them.
Their comedy circuit.
Yeah, yeah.
Presumably, isn't it? That's got to be.
He was storming it, the guy I saw the other night. Yeah, no, they're either that's where they're at. They're in prison. Or I went to a reunion, a kind of friends reunion, a couple of weeks back, and all the people that I really wanted to see didn't turn up because they were either dead or in prison or on a curfew. They couldn't come out after 8 o'clock. This is quite funny, but the real
next
sad
year's reunion bowling at one.
Exactly. The real sad thing about it was something that really, really got to me was some of the people that I used with their children have OD'd and died.
Oh,
and
God.
I thought, oh God, that really sums it up, doesn't it?
Sure.
Yeah. So sure. It's not all laughs, drug addiction.
God.
There's some laughs in there.
Yeah.
Yeah. There is loads of laughs, but I mean, you know. Anyway.
Brilliant.
Enough.
Brilliant. Good. I will. I've been so glued to that. I haven't planned what I'm going to say next.
Okay,
so this will be a sting.
Yeah. I mean, punk. You know, it was my punk rock stand-up comedy.
Yeah.
Really, because in '77, you know, I'd go and see. I saw all those punk bands and all that sort of stuff, and I loved that whole scene. But I was kind of too screwed up or on something to kind of get involved. And unmusical.
Okay.
And so I kind of see
not that unmusical stopped a lot of people.
And now I've, you know, when I started doing stand up, it was a bit like that. Anyone can get up and have a go. I think it is again. So that was my punk rock.
And how were you generating that material? Were you at the time sitting down and writing out longhand, or were you?
I've always
talking about stuff on stage and making it up. What was the?
Oh, I never do stuff on stage.
Okay.
If I say it, it's been written down.
Okay.
Okay. I hardly ever improvise on stage. Well, I'm little tiny little bits, tags maybe on
sure.
the end, but I never improvise a routine.
Sure.
The way I write is, I write it down normally on a computer,
mm-hmm.
And I've got and I learn it basically. Absolutely.
So you write it with jokes complete, and how?
Yeah. Well, that's
yeah.
What I do is I write down the routine exactly as I think it should be said.
Okay.
We've got into the writing bit, haven't we? I write it down exactly as I think it should be said. And then I edit out all unnecessary words, and I make it as concise as I possibly can, and I put the funny where I think the funny is, the gaps there. I write it exactly as it is, but I use a very cunning method of making it not seem scripted. Is I don't actually learn it.
You cunning bastard.
I'm really cunning. I write it down, I make it very careful, this is exactly how it should be said, but then I only roughly learn it.
Okay.
So when I go to say it, I don't know it.
Yes, okay.
But I say it, you know, and then it comes out of my mouth as kind of as I would say it.
Yes.
Rather
yes.
than that. Rather
because you're
than
trying mentally you're not trying to you're not scrabbling for it, but you're just hitting the point which naturally won't
hopefully,
remember,
yeah.
which is, that's a rough approximation of the way people tell stories conversationally, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah.
You remember the sort of key
yeah,
points.
Yeah, yeah, that's how I do it.
And is that's how you started writing and that's how you've continued writing? Has it always been like that? What have been the changes in how that...
Like I was saying earlier, the reason that I like this podcast and I've listened to it is because I don't actually think anyone knows how to write comedy.
Sure.
I think we're all going, God, how do you do it? How do you do it? You know, I think if you knew how to write comedy, then, you know, you'd write yourself a brilliant 2 hours of observational stand-up comedy and tour it and call it the roadshow and make millions of pounds. Okay, some people know, but I bet even Michael McIntyre doesn't know.
Sure.
You know how to write, if you know what I mean. I mean, a friend of mine, Mark Billingham, who used to be a stand-up, and
I've never met him. I've heard of him. Yeah, well, I love looking at, whenever I'm in an airport, I look at his books to see how many names of comics I can find as his characters. Brilliant.
He is a massively successful author, and he's written, I don't know, 12 bestsellers. Okay. Sure. And I was talking to him just the other day, and he's got to start his next book, and he said to me, whenever he starts a book, he thinks he doesn't know how to write a book. Oh, and he thinks, oh my god, I can't do this, and I don't actually know how you write a book. And he says he has to be about a third of the way into it before he goes, oh yeah, okay, I think I've got the hang of it now. But sure. That's after 12, and that's how I feel about
god, that's so depressing. I'm sure I started doing this hoping that people would go, right, here's how you do it. And of course, I mean, they don't, but that, just to think, like, that's always, I've written 3-hour-long shows, and at the beginning of each one, I thought, I just don't know.
Exactly.
To feel that I might be still feeling that 10-hour-long shows down the line is quite terrifying, maybe comforting in the same way. Maybe you release yourself and you go, okay, well, this is it. This is the bit where I don't know what happens.
Yeah, it's really hard. I mean, you know, should we get on to how I write in various different ways, all of them extremely slow. I use the the Jean Perrette method, I think it is.
Okay.
Where I actually, if I'm writing a subject, say I'm writing about, you know, photocopy repairing, whatever, I'll have headings: people, places, things, events, words and phrases.
Okay.
So I will write down all people I can think of that are involved in photocopy repairing in some way, you know, like Mr. Rank Xerox, or you know, Dave, who I work with at the office, and you know, everyone. And I will also write down opposites, so, and I'll look down places, you know, offices, all the places where, things, events, words and phrases, which I get a lot out of, you know, catchphrases, and you know, I'll write down everything I can, and I'll also write down opposites.
Okay.
So when I've done all that, then I'll write down opposites.
Opposites for everything in every column.
Well,
or you would attempt to.
Yeah, just you know, the ones that spring to mind, really.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then I will. I've been using the Mio method, as I call it lately.
Okay, sure, cool.
Mio.
I've not done him yet. Well, I'm sure I will.
because you know, like I say, I'm always saying to people, how do you write? How do you do it? How do you do this? And I said to him, because he's a very prolific writer, how the hell do you write your material? Please tell me. And he's, you know, and he told me, and I went, no, I want a more specific answer. I want to know what you do. Tell me, when you start to write, what do you do? And basically, he does much the same thing. And I've used this method recently, and it's been good. He'll look at the newspapers, he'll find a story he likes, and he won't actually write about that story. He'll write about the basis of that story. So if it's about, you know, the tsunami in Japan, he won't write about that. He'll write about storms or natural disasters or whatever.
Okay.
So that when that story's over, he can still use it.
Oh, that's clever. I might edit that out and keep it.
So that's the first thing that I've been using to do. And then what he'll do is he'll do exactly what I do. He'll do lists or spider diagrams or whatever method.
Some means of plastering
everything you know about
ideas.
That subject.
Yeah.
Okay. And then what he does, he'll do that for, well, this is what I've been doing anyway. I do that for an hour. One full hour of sitting there writing down lists of words, whatever, anything connected, you name it, write it down. And the people, places, things, events, words are just ways to make your mind think of other things that might connect.
Sure.
Then when you've done all that, don't try and write any jokes. You've done all that, go to the gym.
Okay.
I don't go to the gym because I hate it, but I go out on a bike ride.
Okay.
So go out on a bike ride, and quite often I find during that half an hour bike ride, where you're having to kind of do exercise, sometimes ideas pop into your head there and then. So when you've done that, come home, have a shower, go back, look at that work that you've done for one more hour. So you've got to sit there and try and come up with something for an hour.
For another hour's another worth of hour. Generating stuff.
Another hour of looking at it and going, where's the joke here? You know. You don't have to come up with more things for your list, although if you do, fine. You have to then try and get something out of it. And for that, an hour is a hell of a long time.
Yes.
When you've looked at it and gone, I can't find anything funny about
this.
Well, you've got another 55 minutes.
And you have to sit down and do the hour. Yeah. Okay.
And I find if you do that, you will come up with something.
That's brilliant. That's such a whole technique. Do you know what I mean? That's such a whole...
I've only just been doing it that way. And,
okay.
The other thing I use, of course, is Twitter, which is when I'm doing that and I'll come up with some stuff, okay? Mm-hmm. And it's normally not very good. Mm-hmm. And what I'll do is I'll put it on Twitter. If it's a kind of joke that I've come up with, I'll put it on Twitter. And if it gets retweeted and people like it, then I think, oh, well, maybe it's worth pursuing.
Okay.
Maybe it's worth pursuing.
So to use that as a little litmus test of whether or not there's anything in it.
Yeah. Just in the same way as, you know, sometimes you have an idea about a routine, you say it to an audience, and if there's kind of like, you know, if people kind of nod or not even, it doesn't even have to be laughs, but if people kind of identify with it, you get a feeling that there might be something worth working on there.
Sure.
You know, which is the same thing as Twitter. Also, it makes you write it in less than 140 characters, which is can't be a bad thing.
Yes, certainly in terms of word economy and all that kind of thing. Yeah, why not? Yeah.
So
brilliant.
That's one way I do it. And the other way I do it is, and I thought, think you talked about this with Mark Mayer, is give yourself a subject and go, right, write about that for 3 minutes non-stop. Mm. You may not stop. You cannot edit yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You must write constantly. And sometimes you get something out of that.
Sure. Something I've noticed I've been doing recently, or I've become more aware of recently, is when I hit upon a topic and I think, oh, I've never heard anyone do anything about that before.
Yeah.
You think, oh, there might be something in that. Are there particular... Do you have a similar sort of thing? Do you have aerials that kind of go, actually, that might be untouched? Or is it that you... What makes you decide, like, if you're doing that kind of 3 minutes worth of writing how do you zero in on something? What criteria do you look for when you think, oh, this might have something to it? What is that feeling like?
Do you know, of course, the best jokes I've ever written have not come out of any of that.
Yes.
Best jokes I've ever written just come to your head like that and you go, oh, that's a joke. And sadly, that doesn't happen often enough.
No.
To me, that's the way. I mean,
yeah, I can think of like one of my most. I mean, it's clubby. It's a little bit rude, so it's not great for certain environments. But one of my favourite fallback. Oh, hang on, this isn't going quite as well as I thought. I better rip this one out.
Yeah.
I remember exactly where I was standing, coming home with some shopping, when it just fell into my head, and I thought, oh, that's funny.
Yeah. And you always have, there's always a little fear that you've heard someone else say it.
But the problem,
I mean, for instance, my wife's a good thing. If I'll say something to my wife, and you know, for instance, one of my favourite jokes, which I don't do anymore because it got overexposed, but she said to me, you know, it'd be really romantic if I could be buried in my wedding dress. And I said, you know, you better hope you die of some kind of wasting disease, right?
Her reaction was so bad,
I knew immediately that was a good joke.
Yes. Okay.
she was so upset about it that I knew. So then what I do is I've got that joke and I try it out and I know it works. Then I try and write tags.
Yes. Oh, then you, I mean, would you then go, right, wedding dresses, and then take that and do your system with it and stuff like that?
Yeah. Okay. And then I'll try and add to it and make it into a routine.
Because I think that the danger of those moments when a brilliant joke drops into your head is that you go away thinking, oh, I just need to wait for that to happen.
Yeah,
more.
Yeah.
But what we're talking about here is, the fact that you just have to keep...
I think that if you do all that stuff, those jokes are more likely to drop into your head.
Yes.
Certainly when you're riding your bike or at the gym or whatever it is you do in between to get your brain off the subject or to let your subconscious work on it. That's what it's about, really, isn't it? You do your hour, you then go off, let your subconscious turn it over.
Yes. And you come back. Yes, I've certainly never heard that before. That, I mean, that's a really surprising, but I can completely see where that's coming from, of a surprising technique that you go get all that stuff down and then go and do something else. Don't just sit there looking at it and growing more and more depressed.
Exactly. Thinking, I can't do this. What do I ever think I could do this? What's wrong with me? Why am I doing this job I can't do? At the moment, I'm doing corporate work, thanks to McIntyre. Because I, you know,
sure,
you know how it is. People go, oh, we've put you forward for a corporate, and you go, oh, great, and then you never hear from them.
Yes, of course. Yeah.
Well, now they send that little clip of me on McIntyre. They go, oh, he's been on the.
Oh, telly. He's done that.
Yeah, we'll have him, right? So now I'm having to do, you know, just the most hideous, boring, tedious gigs, like, you know, the Institute of Paper Merchants Awards, and which I, you know, the other night I did the, food. And you see, this is how boring it is. I did it 3 days ago. I can't remember what it was. I wrote for it and everything. The Food and Hygiene Standards Agency or something. Okay. Annual dinner, whatever. Anyway, so I will write for that. How I write for that is, and I will do it only because I have a deadline.
Sure.
So that's the only way that makes me write. Yeah, and even then, even then, I had a week to prepare. Even then, I did it in the 3 hours before the gig, panicking and you know, sweating. What I do is I find out everything I can about their tedious business.
Okay.
This is why I got into comedy, because I couldn't fit in these environments, and now I'm back in there.
Yes. Yeah, I always think that whenever I have to wear a suit. Yeah, exactly. This is the whole point of me not doing it. Yeah.
But the comedy circuit seems to be collapsing a bit, so I mean, this is a, you know, it's a good way to kind of, you know, supplement your income. And basically I'll try and just get information about the company. I will find out what the directors' names are, look them up. Are they on Facebook? Are they on LinkedIn? Do you know what I mean? Are they on Twitter?
Yeah.
I look up that. Quite often the website of the company will have the directors with their hobbies. And then, you know, and I will basically write cheap jokes about their hobbies. And so I have a deadline, and then I'm forced to write about it, basically. And, you know, for corporate events, you don't have to do big jokes. You just have to do jokes.
Okay. This is interesting, because I think, I'm sure you gave me this bit of advice, and I've certainly given it to other people and said, oh, this is Mike Gunn's golden rule, which was that when they send you the information for a corporate, you ask, is there a bit of an office joker character?
Yeah.
Can we get him to send me his opinions?
Yeah, yeah. I do.
And then the office joker sends you the opinion. And then the brilliant bit about the advice is you just read them out.
Exactly.
And then
I do that.
They fly, you take the credit. And if they die, you go, God, Collins would have a wanker.
Exactly.
I mean, that's amazing.
I do that, yeah.
Oh, brilliant. I'm glad I've been attributing that correctly. Yeah. But it seemed to me like what I loved about that was the elegance of it, because it just seems like such a wonderful, not a con trick, but a way to just generate gales of laughter.
Old junky trick of
I mean, that's great.
Robbing people of their stuff, basically. the credit.
I always thought that was just priceless. Just the, you know, always get the stuff in advance and then just read it out.
Exactly, that's what I do that, yeah.
But,
and also, I get the name of the person that's given it to me, you know, Dave, whatever it is, and I'll also go, obviously I can't tell you who's given me this information, Dave.
Exactly, that's great.
Especially if it's dying and it's Dave.
Sure. But that's brilliant to hear that the same, because that to me didn't suggest necessarily that you would be someone who would then also do loads of writing on that topic. Is that something you do more now? Is that, I mean, presumably...
No, I do that, but what, you know, whoever they send you, whatever information you get, you just have to add jokes to it, basically.
Okay.
You know, and take the mick out of the people.
Sure.
You know, it can be because I'm not great at improvising, I have to write everything.
Yes,
so I write everything.
You.
So, you know, if they've sent me some stuff about the director and they say, oh, you know, he likes to collect stamps and you know, a long list of stuff, and I go, yeah, apparently you do all this. I think what they're saying is you're a tedious git.
Okay?
Enough to, if you call the director of the company a tedious git, then everyone else thinks it's hilarious.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
You might not get
but
paid,
they love it. They love it because I've seen like some of the testimonials on your website from your corporate work.
Yeah, yeah.
You're someone that really nails that, and you can tell how much they warm to it.
Not always.
Okay, all right.
I've died horribly as well.
Because presumably you don't get to test that stuff out anywhere.
No,
you arrive there with
it, yeah,
a bunch of new stuff floating around. I mean, I've certainly done that. I did the London Transport Awards.
It's so nerve-wracking, isn't it?
I did like an hour and a half beforehand in the hotel room got in the building that it was going to happen in. And I was just writing stuff there and then, because that was that immediate deadline thing, you know. and then you walk on. So part of me thinks, forget this, just walk on and do the best job you can with what you've got, rather than be on there with these ideas falling out of your head and not being able to remember things, you know. So it's really a really good skill, although we might kind of, you know, laugh at it, but that seems like you're putting a lot of work in there and actually justifiably getting some good rewards from it.
It's horrific though, isn't it? It's
horrible. Horrible. It's horrific.
It's like fixing up really bad speed. You feel like all your whole body's like, you know, your skin doesn't fit and it's just horrible.
I really you're going on for in an environment that is harder than a comedy club.
Oh yeah,
with exactly. Fewer of your natural weapons.
Stupid, like, you know, and it's always, isn't it always, you know, well, we've set it up really nicely. Oh great, well the stage is here and the audience are right.
Yeah, right. Because we're not allowed to put chairs on the dance floor.
No! Exactly. It's all that, and you know, I had a fantastic one the other day. It was for O2 or something. Anyway, it was. I write all the stuff, and I have it on my computer. And when I get back, I delete it immediately. I put it into the trash bin, so there is nothing left. There is nothing.
You're very orderly. Your practice.
I'm very disorderly, really. But But anyway, I did this one for O2, and I got there and I didn't really have much and I was dreading it. It was a horrible room and I was thinking, oh God, I'm going to die. And then one of the staff said to me, I said, what have you been doing today? You know, well, we've had PowerPoint presentations. And I went, oh, yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. He said, no, well, everyone wrote down their motto for life.
Okay.
I went, really? I went, yeah. She said, yeah, we all wrote down our own motto. And I went, really? I said, is there a list of the mottos and who wrote them?
Amazing.
And she went, yeah, I think so. I'll get it for you. So she just got me the list of, you know, Dave from Accounts wrote, who dares wins, you know. And I managed to do the whole gig by just reading out those.
That's incredible. And they must have been happy as Larry.
They're happy
That's
as Larry.
Brilliant.
Dave, who dares wins? Well, you know you work in a phone shop, don't you, Dave?
Yeah.
Do you know
what I mean? Oh, that's
have you got one of those little phone holsters that looks like a gun, Dave? That sort of stuff. They loved it.
But, yeah. Given that sometimes it feels like it, what are the stakes? I was going to say that it feels like it's high stakes because often for a corporate you're being paid, you know, not be 10 times what you're getting on the circuit or more.
Yeah.
But so you feel the impetus to do a good job. You feel like you have to do a good job. Do you?
Yeah. Well, I feel like I have to not die. That's what I feel.
Okay.
Like.
So what I'm getting at is, do you feel like it's okay to take the risks of doing stuff that you've written specifically for them? In order to do really well for them, what's the balance of risk going on there?
It's not so much that. What it is that's what they want. They don't want, you know, you can do your finest home joke and they don't care. Yeah.
Yes.
You know what I mean, they're not interested. What they want you to go is, oh, look at Dave's stupid hair.
Yeah, sure. But you need to have incredible jokes to be able to get the gig. And then once you've got the gig, you know what I mean, you've given on McIntyre and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
And then once you've got the gig, it's about being. Just funny.
Yeah, I mean, I can't, you know, I'm not very good at doing that. Oh, you know, what do you do? And, you know, look at your hair. I'm not very good at that. I don't really do that. I've never compared. Because I'm really totally unsuitable to compare. Yeah. I've tried a few times.
Have you really? I would say
no.
I wouldn't understand why you were unsuitable to compare. You make an excellent compare.
Because, I'll go, oh, what do you do? Where are you from? Don't care. Not interested.
Yeah.
The few times I have tried comparing, I've talked to the first person, then said something rude to them.
Okay.
And then no one wants to talk to me for the rest of the gig.
Oh no.
No, I'm not very good at comparing.
Okay.
No, it's not really. I keep thinking I should learn, shouldn't I? I should just go and do comparing, but I don't think I've got that kind of. Have I got a sort of warm compare-y sort of? Thing, have
I? Oh, you do have a kind of warmth. It's a kind of warmth. But you do. The conversation we're having now, you're making me laugh through things you've prepared and said before and things you've only just thought of. You know, that's all comparing is, really.
I suppose.
And you have that, you have a warmth, and you're coming at it from a much more interesting angle than a generic warmth, which a lot of compares have. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That kind of, hey, great to be here thing.
Yeah.
It's very uninteresting. I think some of the best compares, if you look at someone like Alan Cochran, you know, he never comes on and says, hey, it's great to be here.
No.
But he compares in spite of his dour
nature. Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, you're right. I probably could do it.
Put your finger out, Mike. Go do some compare.
I'll start rowing my own night.
Oh, God. Oh, dear. That's another thing. Like the comparing thing where it would be great to have those gears. oh God, it'd be great to run a night. I just don't want to run a night. Yeah. Wouldn't it be useful in every respect if I could put up with running a night?
Well, especially with the whole comedy circuit collapsing, I wish you would run a night and book me.
Yeah, okay. Let's talk about that. It's the second time that's come up. I mean, is it collapsing? It's certainly, is it ever going to look like it did 5 years ago ever again?
I don't know. I've got no idea. I hope so, because otherwise, you know, I can't do anything else.
Yeah, sure.
You know, I've got a long history of drug addiction, a criminal record, and I haven't done a proper job for 20 years, you know.
You've got a McIntyre clip. That's your CV from now, Sunshine. You can get to anywhere with that. You can be a judge with that.
Who's going to employ me? No, seriously, though, I don't know. I mean, the sort of Jonglers scene has kind of collapsed, hasn't it? I mean,
Jonglers and Highlight both seem to be... they kind of cut right back and kind of improve the clubs that they do have, and now maybe those are coming back. Whether they end up expanding again and how long that takes, I don't know.
I mean, a few years ago you could kind of, you know, you would do Thursday, Friday, Saturday somewhere like, you know, Jonglers Leicester, and also double it with Jonglers Nottingham. So you'd do two shows a night, you know, you'd make quite a lot of money over the weekend, and then the rest of the time you could do what you wanted. That'd be enough to live quite comfortably on.
Yeah.
But that's all gone, isn't it?
Yeah.
That doesn't exist anymore. You know, now you'll be... now it's kind of like one night in Leicester, which it's not worth going. It's just not worth going to Leicester for one Saturday night gig with the price of petrol and all that nonsense.
Yeah.
So you're better off, and I'm happier to just do a couple of little gigs in London, you know, for less money, less petrol expenses, and be at home.
Yes.
You know, so that it's changed massively. I don't know what's going to happen.
Talking about other comics on the circuit, what sorts of things do you see that inspire you? Which comedians in particular inspire you and make you think, wow, that's what I want to be like? If that is a thing,
what inspired me are great routines. That's what inspired me. I'd like to write a great bit. Do you know what I mean? That's what I want to do. I want people to go, oh yeah, that, do you know Mike Gunn's bit on that? You know,
yes.
That's what I want.
Yes.
Like, you know, there are bits that kind of lift people, aren't there, out of, you know, like Ed Burns' ironic routine.
Yes.
You know, at the time, even Madonna was talking about it in the press at the time. You know, they're just some great routines, aren't they? Like Gavin Webster's stuff about pandas.
Yes. You know,
that's really what I like to do. I'd like to try and write a great routine. That's always what I'm, you know, that's what I'm after. Something that people go, oh yeah, that's my, you know, like the seven stages of drinking or whatever.
Yeah,
you know, those routines. That anyway.
Oh, that's made me want to hear that all over again. I haven't heard that in years.
You know, I saw McIntyre at the O2 recently, and he's got a great big routine about going to the dentist. And, it, you know, it's one of those, you just go, yeah, you know.
That's covered.
Yeah. That's really kind of, you know, that's what I'm always wanting to do.
And has that been the same since you started doing comedy? Was that a thing that at the time made you go, that's what I want to do?
No,
or at the time were you just going, I want to exist as a comic?
I didn't even want to do that really when I started. Yeah. What my ambition when I started was to do 10 minutes at the Comedy Store. That was my ambition.
Yeah.
That was really what I wanted to do. I wanted to do, and then once I'd done that, then I wanted to do a good 10 minutes.
Yeah, but that's good. That's good. I did a marketing thing. I did a marketing day at Equity, like a free training day. That is what they would call a SMART goal, because it is specific, measurable, achievable. And then two other things beginning with R and T. But that's a really good. That one of the things that constantly frustrates me about this, you know, is the flip side of the ludicrous romance of being able to do and go wherever you want.
Yeah.
All that freedom.
Yeah.
The flip side of that is that you have to make your own goals, and then no one else pats you on the back necessarily or tells you when you've done it. I find that a very difficult... I've talked to on the show about that before.
I find it very difficult as well. Like I say, I mean, you know, I will sit and, you know, and write for a deadline, you know, and try and come up. But literally, even then, it'll be like a few hours before the actual deadline.
Yeah.
But if I've got no deadline, you know, oh God, I'll look at Facebook or, you know, whatever. You know, there's always something else that I could be doing, you know. as that sort of that stair gate's broken downstairs and he's whatever.
And by the time that's done, you've had a cup of tea, now you've got to wash that up, and then you go look at all the other washing up. Yeah, completely.
Exactly. You know, I do find it very hard to motivate myself to do. Mm. You know, very hard to sit down and write, because I find it difficult to write. You know? Like I say, that's why I like this podcast, because. Mm. Like you, I think, oh, I might find out the secret.
Yeah. What
idiot. I've got a book down here called Comedy Writing Secrets.
I've got that one. There's nothing secret.
There's no
in that
secret.
Book. That's the real book. I should do one. The Comedian's Comedian, The Real Secret of Writing Comedy. Just one page. Work hard. There we are.
Here's the real secret of writing comedy. This book, I use this one, Dictionary of Idioms and Catchphrases.
Oh, no.
That's what I use.
Very nice. Okay.
If you look at that, although, of course, nowadays you can just Google that.
Well, no, you can't, because then you're online and then Facebook is one click away, so you've got to stay away.
I'll tell you another thing I do, which I just thought about writing, is if I'm writing about, I don't know, crossing the line, for instance, whatever it is I'm writing about, photocopiers, spiders, whatever, if I just type the word spider into Google, and I don't look at all the things, I just look at the list of stuff that comes up.
Yes,
so, you know,
that's quite a good way of generating
stuff for your list. Okay. I mean, there'll probably be Spider Jiving by Andy Fairweather Lowe. An old song from, you know, 70s or something. So stuff like that will come up and I'll go, okay, singers, you know, the sing about spiders, you know. Just makes me it's just ways of making your brain look at it from a different point of view. And the other thing I do is, once I've got all this stuff and I'm looking for an angle, I will look at it from another angle, basically. I'll go, well, what does this look like to somebody who's looking at it from outside?
Okay.
So the story is about these two people. What does it look like to somebody who's looking at them? What does it sound like to somebody that's looking at them and not seeing what they're not knowing what they're talking about? You know, just try and make my brain come up with some sort of.
That's fascinating. I was going to say, because some of the listenership of this podcast are people who aren't comedians, let's just talk about what an angle means initially in terms of comedy. Like, you come at a subject from an angle. Is that the same thing as a premise? Like with one of your very well-known bits that you've got, you know, all your money is tied up in your parents' house.
Oh, yeah.
So the premise there is...
Cunning.
That was an accident. It was an accident. I watched it on YouTube this morning. The premise there is that you are encouraging your parents to die to get at the money. So that would be...
Well,
that
the
would
angle be, is... I'm the angle. Yeah, I suppose... The angle is... I mean, most people... I think most people probably have thought that. What am I going to get when my parents die?
Sure.
But do most people verbalise it? I don't think they do.
I feel like I'm fairly sure neither of my parents will listen to this show. No. But I think at the same time, I think... I don't think I have ever thought that.
Maybe it's my sort of... Yeah. You know, like I say, I think that if you have a kind of fairly kind of screwed up background, then you have a kind of darker sense of humour.
Oh, sure.
If you're a comic, you have a darker sense of humour, because after a while, you know, the average kind of pleasant little joke doesn't do it for you.
Yes,
it's
of
a bit,
course.
You know, it's progressive, but like all things, you get a tolerance for nice jokes.
Yeah.
And after a while, you go, oh, that Frankie Boyle's a bit tame. I want some of the A-class jokes, you know.
So looking at ideas from other people's perspectives, other people that are either involved in the joke or might not be involved in the joke. That's
or who it affects as well. There's things like, you know, who's this going to affect? You could look at that from.
Yeah, I'm terrible at doing those. Tell me loads of those. Loads of possibilities. I'm really awful at doing that. All of my stuff is me.
Yeah, if you look at a story, like for instance, you know, my dad dying story, you can go, okay, you know, who's it going to affect? It's going to affect him. Mm-hmm. And who benefits? It's quite a, you know, it's going to benefit me. So quite often I'll look at that. What do other people get out of this?
Yes,
you know, that's another angle to look at. And like I say, all this stuff is just to make your head kind of your brain work. But very often it's none of this.
Yes,
you know, I might start writing a joke about something, and I'll end up writing a joke about something completely different.
Sure.
And then what you what I tend to do is go, no, I'm writing about this, not that.
Yes,
but what you should do.
Quick, I've been all of these brilliant ideas I'm having because I try and work on this rubbish. Yeah.
Exactly. What you should do is just go with that and go, okay, you know, and then try and do that, you know. I mean, I wrote a whole load of stuff about just recently they changed the law to make it illegal to drug drive.
Okay.
Yeah, only just recently, bizarrely, and I immediately thought, wow, that should be a subject for me.
Sure,
I should write jokes about that because I've done a lot of drug driving in my time. I write down everything I know. I didn't really... I came up with a load of jokes. Mm. None of them are very good, you know. And I've tried and I thought, I'm going to give up on this now, you know. How are the police going to know you're drug driving? You know, one of the jokes I wrote was if they pull you up and you're wearing a seatbelt, but it's tied around your arm.
That's a good joke. Yeah.
If they pull you over and say, blow in this bag, and you're so stoned, you say, no, blows in this bag. You know, so I wrote a load of gags like that, but, you know, they never really worked. They worked all right, but not good enough.
Yeah.
This might be something quite interesting for your listenership. It was I wrote a whole routine about iPhone video calling,
okay.
Which I thought was a brilliant routine.
Mm-hmm.
And I ran it in little tryout nights, okay, because I had to do the Live at the Comedy Store show, which would be out showing now, okay. But it was good money. I didn't have a new routine that I could do on it. So I thought, right, I will do one and I will take... Now, they offered it me and I thought, yes. They said, have you got some new stuff to do? And I said, yes, although I didn't.
Brilliant. Okay. Deadlines, lovely.
Yeah, exactly. I thought, I had a deadline. And I wrote this routine about... it was actually an old routine from years ago, which never worked.
Mm.
About, and I thought, but now video calling is... It was a routine about what's going to happen when we have video calling.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So I dug it out. Like, right, okay. And I ran it in. I wrote it. I rewrote it. And I ran it in all these little tryout nights. It went great. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And I then did it on the Live at the Comedy Hall show, and it'll be out there now on Paramount. But having done it, and now I've tried it in proper clubs, it doesn't work.
Okay.
It doesn't work.
Okay.
And part of the reason it doesn't work is because it's badly written. Because those little clubs, you know, you go on after people that are really new and they don't...
Yes.
You've just got confidence and, you know, you can get away with it.
You get a false positive reaction.
Yeah, false positive.
Yeah.
Also... It was nonsense because I was talking about doing video calls and I was miming having the phone at my ear. Which, of course, you don't when you do a video. You hold it in front of your face, don't you?
Yes.
You look at it. It was only after it had been recorded and, you know, and it's now out there on Paramount.
Yeah,
that I suddenly dawned, hang on a minute.
Hey, listen, if you didn't notice...
I'm looking like a right muppet here.
Maybe a lot of people out there won't notice.
But anyway, so of course I changed it and I'm now doing it that way, but it still doesn't work.
Did it work on the recording?
Yeah.
Well, you're fine then, as long as there's people in the room laughing at that. You know, that's just...
That makes no difference for a TV recording, as you know.
I suppose.
But anyway, and so now I'm going to try and redo it, because I still think it's a funny idea. The idea is that we don't really want video calling because the phone's for lying, you know.
Yes, okay.
It's bad enough having to, you know, put on the sick voice when you're ringing at work.
But now you've got to do full makeup.
You've got to do the sick face, you've got to have makeup, you know. What if you're not at home, you'll need scenery, you know. I wrote this whole thing about, you know, there'll be a scenery app that you can get that just makes it look like you're somewhere. And, you know. Anyway, didn't work.
Do you have any kind of maxims or mottos that you write to? Do you have any things where you're just going, oh, I can't come anything with this, and you go, nope, stick to the rule?
No, I don't. No.
Okay.
No, I was thinking I should have a catchphrase. Everyone needs a catchphrase.
Yeah, go on.
And somebody suggested I should have "No, you fuck off." Which I actually think
is
quite a good
idea. Is that for use on stage? Yeah, you're kind of on a motivational poster on top of your desk.
For use on stage.
That's a good one.
It's a good catchphrase, isn't it? Might have been Joe Caulfield that suggested it, I think, on Twitter.
Joe's fantastic.
Yeah. I might try it.
Mm. Yeah, why not? There's that calls to mind something, actually, just about the work you do in commercial clubs as opposed to the work that is either going to get you on TV or that you could do on TV. Because the kind of the thing that I imagine there is a rule that if you do stuff that's got too much swearing in it or is too sexually based, it's not going to get you on TV. or is not going to make it onto TV?
No, I'm fairly clean anyway. I mean, I don't do that much swearing.
Sure.
And I do very little sort of graphic sex stuff.
Okay.
So I don't have to change it too much.
Sure.
When I did the McIntyre thing, I had to change the word wank to happy ending.
Okay. Yeah.
And not much else, really. I didn't have to change.
I've done something very similar with an adaptation of one of my lines, and actually I find that I've stuck with the cleaner version.
Yeah.
Because actually it's sort of it takes away, you know, what it loses in kind of plosive punch, it probably benefits from in terms of not turning off certain
things. Exactly, yeah. It's harder to do it cleaner, but I think it's worth the effort because you don't have to edit for, you know, you don't have to edit for to do TV things. And I've done bits on radio and Radio 4 and all that. That's got to be clean. I did a whole thing about drugs on Radio 4 on Shappy's show.
Mm.
It was fairly easy to keep that clean because I'm relatively clean. I mean, I have dark subjects, but they're not swearing. And
Sure.
And also, to do corporate events, they always want it clean.
Yes.
Well, the audience don't, but the bookers do.
Yeah, the bookers have to be seen to have told you.
Yeah, exactly. So it's quite hard to kind of... If you're used to doing filth and swearing, it's quite hard to edit it out. I think it's probably best to keep it cleanish.
Mm.
Although, like I say, I went to see McIntyre at the O2 the other night. I've never seen him swear so much.
Really?
Yeah.
I suppose he's at a stage now where he does what he wants.
I suppose so. And I suppose also, you know, he's at the O2. And there was a very funny little bit where he did something. He went, "Ooh, I'm improvising at the O2. And whether or not that's a line or not,
sure.
I don't know, because he's very, you know, he looks very natural, but he works very hard.
Yes.
Yes. Or I really think he did actually catch himself improvising at the O2.
Yeah, it sounds like the sort of thing you'd say if you did catch yourself doing that. That sounds like a momentary peek behind the...
It was very good. He was very good. I've written the Mio method here. 1 + 1 + 1.
Okay.
It's 1 hour of working plus 1 hour of exercising plus 1 hour of working.
Okay. Were these your notes in advance of the podcast?
Yeah, no, it just reminded me I just wrote down Gene Perret, and Mio, spider diagrams. Oh, and the other one's The Artist's Way. Oh, yeah, that was. You just write. There's a book called The Artist's Way. Do you know it?
I don't know. I think I've heard of it. I've not seen
it. Yeah, it's this. It basically says, you know, get on with it. It's one of these.
This is all going in my book. I'm going to end up doing a comedian book. It's just going like to be
covering your creative self. It's just ways to make you get on with it.
Okay.
It's the same shit. It says just write. As all these things do, it says just write. Yeah, that's all.
So that was Mike. What a fascinating conversation. And remember, there's another 40 minutes worth of stuff, all sorts of things about plagiarism and more stuff on corporates. Mike's fabulous tour that he did with Sean Collins, some really interesting ideas there about how they did a sort of a double header tour, and some very specific tips for acts who are doing the tryout spot at the Comedy Store in London. Plus, Mike talking about his experiences on the Edinburgh Fringe. All of those available as a free MP3 download if you go to comedianscomedian.com/Mike, M-I-K-E. Go there, get those, put in your email address. That'll download automatically if you've done that before. If not, then you just need to follow a couple of steps to sign up and you'll end up on my mailing list, which, as everyone will know, I don't use to spam you because I never get around to it. That's everything. Next week... Oh my God, I don't know what order they're coming out in, but later today I'm going to interview the brilliant Keith Farnan, a fantastic Irish comic who a lot of you will know and love. So that one's coming up. I've also spoken to Phil Burgers, aka Dr. Brown, and we managed to squeeze in almost exactly 1 hour of chat, which I might well put up unedited because it's a shot in the arm. it's an unbelievable interview. So I don't know when that will come out, but soon, I hope. Also got lots more live stuff. I know a lot of you have been asking about Rod Gilbert, about Pappies, about Abanderman, and they're all going to be coming up soon that were live in Edinburgh just gone. So that's all the stuff. Thank you very much to everyone for listening. Remember, funny for no money or hack for cash if you want to tweet me at ComComPod with your ideas about whatever it was I said earlier on. I've forgotten. What was it? Was it birds and crime? It's Birds and Crime. Go for it. So do chuck in those. Keep telling people about the show. I love that you're all getting behind it and supporting it. I really appreciate it. And we'll be back soon with a lot more great stuff. Last thing is, just all the thank yous, really. Thank you to BBC Worldwide. Thank you to Tom Wateracre, Graham Crockford, and all the usual dudes for helping out. Hello to Horace, as usual, and I will speak to you all soon. Bye-bye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Guy Raz, and on my show, Wisdom from the Top, I talk with CEOs and business leaders about the toughest challenges of their careers.
There's lots of ways to measure success.
Sometimes a company has to bet against itself.
We wanted to set ourselves apart by having a point of view.
Businesses really impact people's lives in pretty fundamental ways.
On Wisdom from the Top, some of the greatest business leaders of our time share their intimate stories of leadership, innovation, and transformation. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. Check out Wisdom from the Top only on Luminary. Now, back to your show.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.